Oh yeah, it's only about the very last part of your talk, which I really enjoyed. In the latest edition of the Thompson, he actually takes to heart the point that you've made, and he's revised his revisionist position, as it were, and he throws his hands up to it. And he literally says that in the appendix there that he was biased by his Stalinist alliances, and he's actually seen through that, and he said that it's more the... he sees now more the validity of the case that Morris was putting forward, and how different it was to the case that he manipulated it, if you like. But I just thought,
yeah, well, yeah.
For him to do.
No, I mean, it's quite good that a person should have the intellectual honesty to do that, but I still don't think that E.P. Thompson has come to realise what Morris meant by socialism. I mean, Morris used a term which is slightly ambiguous, state socialism. I mean, obviously today we would call that state capitalism. I mean, what E.P. Thompson now said, oh, well, perhaps it was too much centralisation, perhaps there was too much state, we must have a bit of decentralisation. It comes up with some sort of market socialism, you know, once again, in inverted commas. I mean, as I say, we can pay tribute to E.P. Thompson for having had the honesty to admit that he was a Stalinist bastard and his daughter. But he still hasn't understood, I mean, because, I mean, you know, Morris stood for, he stood for the abolition of private ownership, class monopoly in the means of wealth production. The only alternative was, as I said, to have common ownership, democratic control, free access, which means no money. I didn't have time to say it also means no state, no government, and so on. I mean, this is what Morris meant by socialism, not some sort of reformed version of, you know, what exists in Russia without the concentration camps and a bit more power given to industrial managers. That's not what William Morris meant by socialism. So I don't want to steal Steve's thunder, but I mean, we've had Morris the Stalinist, Morris the Leninist, we've got Morris the Third World Nicaraguanist now, and Morris the ecologist. But in fact, none of them have seemed to realise that he was a socialist using more or less the same language as we do, in the same sense. I mean, there were confusions on one or two points, but I mean, I can't understand how people can really read what Morris wrote. I mean, not necessarily news from nowhere, which I can understand might put off some people because of the language in which it's written, and suggesting that we're all going to have to dress in colourful clothes like the ruling class in the 14th century. But I mean, nothing is preventing us doing that. Rather, it's preventing you doing it, but you won't catch me dressing like that.
Eddie.
I went to a meeting at the Marx Memorial Library on Morris and Marx the other day, and unfortunately, unlike our meetings, I don't say they didn't intend having a discussion period, but surprise, surprise, they didn't get round to it. But what I had wanted to ask wasn't E.P. Thompson, but he made very favourable references to E.P. Thompson, and he happened to be standing, because he was in Marx Memorial Library, under a bronze bas-relief of Lenin, who had worked there, of course, producing Iskra for a couple of years in exile. And what I wanted to discuss was, we know that E.P. Thompson decided after a number of years that Morris wasn't any longer a Stalinist. Could he comment on whether he thought that in the next edition, E.P. Thompson would decide he wasn't a Leninist either? But what I personally wanted to raise, it's not criticism of the excellent talk Adam gave, but it was, as they say in the third world these days, perhaps a little Eurocentric. And whilst he gave very interesting, extremely interesting examples of a utopian thought, and whilst the kind of examples he gave actually committed themselves to specific writing, I'd like his comments anyway. I'd like it to be sort of considered that working people throughout the world do have parallel experiences to draw on. In other words, it's not some peculiarity of this corner of the working world that there are these long-term experiences and struggles and folk memories, if you like, which can serve to inspire and fire the socialist movement. Of course, we are concerned with the scientific application of these ideas, so that they cease being merely beautiful dreams and become a practical proposal, and that was Marx's great contribution. But you don't only need to go to France or Antwerp or here to find parallel experiences and examples. There were not only patterns of life which are remembered and serve as an inspiration in Europe, but as we recently were reminded by an extremely interesting television programme where a group of, it so happened, English people are working in Peru restoring certain irrigation systems and agricultural methods that the Incas had before the civilised Spaniards came along and destroyed it. In certain aspects of Inca society, there were patterns that, as compared to the degradation of today, are quite inspiring and fascinating. Similar experiences can be drawn upon by Mexicans looking into their past, Persians looking into their past, Indians, and so on. So I know that you could well touch upon those as well, but can I throw that in for your reactions as to the Eurocentric dangers of utopia?
Well, I personally would be prepared to argue with you, if you like, that communist or a communistic type of society is the natural social condition of mankind, in the sense that it's not socialism or communism that's against human nature, but it's capitalism and class society. And of course, that originally mankind throughout all the world did live under conditions which are going to be described as communistic. I mean, there wasn't private property, there wasn't any state machinery, as Eddie quite correctly points out. I mean, this is a folk memory, and not only a folk memory. There were survivals of this in practice, which didn't have any written expression right into ancient times, right down into medieval times, and even down to this day. There are people that have been living under, I mean, I'm using the word communistic. So it's you can find in an earlier draft of this talk, I was, to go back to all this, you started with, the Bible once again, whether that is a record of, more or less forged, but I mean, it's a record of, what happened 2,000-3,000 years ago of a certain group of people. I mean, and there, these ideas are coming up, and I'm quite prepared to believe you. I know it's a case that this happens everywhere, and I would suggest that, one of the reasons why it happens everywhere is that, as I said, communism is, in a sense, communism perhaps, the natural social condition of mankind. And, I mean, I was also going to mention, I had to cut the thing short, as to whether, in fact, in communism, has always been a solution to the problem of propertyless classes in society. I mean, this was the case in ancient Rome. It was a case of the slaves. It was a case in feudal times. It was a case at the beginning of capitalism with Moore and Wittgenstein, just as it is the case today. I mean, that was objectively the only solution to the problem. Obviously, if you're propertyless, any way you can end oppression and exploitation is by establishing some sort of communist society. I mean, the real question that comes up, of course, and we could argue about this, as to what sort of communistic society would have been possible, or whether it would have been viable, whether whether it could have lasted. But one thing that we can say, for instance, obviously in the 17th century, you couldn't have established the sort of world socialism that we want, and the only sort of socialism that is possible today. I don't think, in fact, even in the 17th century, you could have established what Wittgenstein was advocating in one country, because I mean that would have distorted everything. Because first of all, I mean he says there's no money, but they do have to keep money for trading with other countries, and also they have to have an army in case they invade from other countries. So you can see, if you like, if this program have implemented, the seeds of degeneration would have already been there. But of course, it couldn't hardly degenerated into some sort of state capitalism, because I mean that would have been ahead of the time. But I mean presumably some sort of communistic experiments like was tried in America in the last century could have been possible. I mean this was the sad fate of the people who were communists before our era. And since once again we're still talking about William Morris, one of his other utopian writings, The Dream of John Ball, which incidentally is come back to this English language, is supposed to be written in English, but it's less comprehensible than the real thing. You know what Wittgenstein and even Shakespeare, because Morris had this idea that you should try and have a sort of purified English language. We just used Anglo-Saxon word anyway. But anyway, but that's not that makes it difficult to read a Dream of John Ball. But it's basically about an incident during the Peasants' Revolt of 1381, where you have John Ball, who is a priest with communist ideas, and somebody comes back from the socialist comes back to the 14th century from the 19th century and explains to him, well, yes, you're right, you've got the remedy, but unfortunately, it's not going to come in your time. That what you're fighting for, and similar things, is going to lead not to socialism, not to communism, but to capitalism. But eventually, socialism will be established as the change beyond the change. And I mean, I think that's, as I say, it's a tragic situation that these people like John Ball, Winstanley, and their equivalents on the continent, because there were plenty of other people advocating communist ideas in Europe. I don't know whether they were still doing that in the Middle East and South America at the same time, but probably were, in fact, in South America anyway. But as I say, I think Morris dealt with this question quite well. I mean, that is the tragedy. It could only be been established except on a very small scale as the change beyond the change. Well, now we've had the first change, and I mean, this is what makes utopia a reality, if you like. I mean, now anything is possible. These ideas of having a society without money, without classes, without the state can be implemented more or less straight away once people are prepared to consciously make the change.
Does that answer your question, Eddie?
I think you're coming, Jim. I guess I'd say one of the two. I'm very glad to speak because I'm roving over the socialist, early socialist, to the degree. But I'm thinking about books for people not so academic, the simple book. And one that comes to mind, I think you did cover more simple books, and a little later, because my early book that impressed me was Fred Henderson's The Simple Case for Socialism. I've never met a book quite as simple and good to introduce young people to the socialist ideas. He was a friend of Morris. He set up the Norwich Socialist Society about the same period as Morris. He was the last Englishman to be condemned to the treadmill. That was a terrible old fashioned thing that I had. And it was for preaching his socialist ideas that he was done. Now, the other book that springs to mind, interestingly enough, I did mention that to some young socialists in the 1947, because I read that in the 20s, 1920s. And they wrote to the publishers, and lo and behold, Fred Henderson was still alive, and he went and lectured to them. He travelled right across the country from Norwich. By that time, he was a great old man. He'd become the Lord Mayor of Norwich, and he took all the trouble to go and talk to these young socialists about this book and his early ideas. The other book that I was going to mention is Shaw's The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism and Capitalism. The strange book came out. I was still at school, and I was going to the children's library. And I asked for this book, and they said, oh, it's in the adult section, you see. So I went into the adult library. It was very strange. Time I borrowed this book, and I found it was a pretty beefy book to borrow. The lady there was a bit embarrassed. She took the dust cover off and handed me the book. It was up on the shelf, you know, it wasn't on the shelf. And I read this book, and it was only years and years afterwards that I saw the dust cover, and it happened to be a female figure, just the top half of a naked female figure, which in those days, that was 1928, I think, was beyond the pale in the library. But the other thing about that book is that I used to go to Hyde Park in those days and listen to Tony Turner. And I say this, I have an admiration for the socialist part of Great Britain and having such a speaker. He was a marvellous propagandist. But when I went back and found out where this material came from, practically all that Tony said in the park had come from the Intellectual Spy. He used it as a basis for some of his most marvellous speeches. It's good stuff, and Tony had a way of putting things over in a simple way, and he used to get audiences of several thousand there. I think he was one of the greatest propagandists, if I may say, possibly of all time, for the open air speaker for the man in the street. Have your opinion?
Yes. Well, I personally have not read the book by Shaw that you mentioned, but being Shaw has always struck me as being the original intellectual playboy. But on the other hand, I have read the book by Fred Henderson. In fact, I think you said he was the last person to be sentenced to the treadmill, but I think he was the last socialist in the Labour Party, because I came across a pamphlet by him in 1955 where he was saying socialism necessarily means a world without money, at least a society without money. And I would prepare to bet he was the last person, maybe being Lord Mayor of Norwich, to advocate that in the Labour Party. I mean, his book, The Case for Socialism, is in our party library, and I'd be prepared to recommend members to read it, because he has, as you say, he does have an easy, simple style, and he does make his point. I mean, as previous speakers have pointed out, we've never denied that there were, I mean, he was an ILP man, I think, but there were people around at the turn of the century, at the time our party was formed, who had the same ideas as we did, the same objective as we did. Our criticism of them is that they were wrong about how to achieve this, and people like Fred Henderson and the others thought they could achieve it through the independent Labour Party and through the Labour Party, and we said no. I mean, and you must first have a majority. Understand, people must first want socialism before you can have it. These people, well, in fact, Henson might well have said that, but I mean, they thought you could do things in the meantime, you know. And what has happened? Well, we've survived, but the Labour Party, well, it hasn't survived. The Labour Party has become a simple instrument of capitalist reform and capitalist administration. But I mean, as I say, I don't know whether Steve will agree with me, but this book, Case for Socialism by Fred Henderson, is in our party library. You know, read it and judge for yourself. I don't say we give you with every phrase in it, but there are parts of it that are very good.
Mike, you want to ask?
Yeah, I just wanted to throw open something for this week, and I'll just firstly quote principle number 6 in the Great Paper Standard. This machinery of government, including the armed forces of the nation, exists only to conserve the monopoly by the capitalist class, the wealth taken from the workers. The working class must organise consciously and politically the conquest of the powers of government, national and local, in order that this machinery, including these forces, may be converted from the instrument of oppression into the agent of emancipation and the overthrow of privilege, aristocratic and plutocratic. Now, as you quite rightly said, Marx and Morris envisaged a transitional phase between capitalism and communism that, as you said, is termed lower communism. This is established the ladder on the way to full communism, to higher levels of communism. Now, I don't know. See, I'm very dubious about the parliamentary road to this lower level of communism, let alone the higher level of communism, because I don't honestly think the ruling class are going to give up what they've got without the politics, because they've got the majority of parliamentary parliament. In Chile, in 1973, the majority of the electorate, including members of the armed forces, voted the Popular Front government into office, and the ruling class just regrouped outside of the country, and in a couple of months, this is even though the members of the armed forces deserted and rebelled, all of the people that were behind the right wing from outside the country with roots came back a couple of months later, killed Allende, and just reinstated their own parliament. So it would appear to me, and I started off by quoting Principle 6, specifically because it says, including these forces may be converted, you see, and I would just throw this out for discussion, but they aren't going to let themselves be converted. They've got to be smashed, completely smashed.
I think slightly off the topic itself, although obviously it's a very important point. I think maybe Adam could deal with that in the winding up, in a sense.
Well, no. I mean, this is a CP tactic, not to answer questions when they're posed. I think you must deal with the question when it's asked. You mustn't say we'll deal with it at the end, because then you just don't deal with it. No, I mean, but I mean, I'll deal with it very, very briefly, because it isn't. Well, I mean, it could be a subject, because William Morris might have been admitted to our party, but he might also have been expelled from our party. But no, I mean,
you win some, you lose.
I think on this question of parliamentary action or political action, as I'd prefer to say, you've got to see how the situation will change between now and then. I mean, it's the key. I mean. The key thing that you must have is a majority of people who want and understand socialism. I mean, using parliament is a mere means, a mere technical instrument to actually get there. So that in fact, you know, one of the quotes that we give in this month's Socialist Standard from Morris is quite good. He says, "I never denied we should use parliament mechanically." I mean, that's our proposition. You're just using it as a means, as a lever, the obvious one that's around at the present time. But I can't let, we'll spend too much time, but I can't let the wrong facts about Chile go. I mean, not only were the people that voted for Chile, for Allende, not socialists, but they weren't even a majority. There was a peculiar electoral system. It exists here as well. It's a normal, it's the same system that exists here. So you've got three candidates standing for the presidency. You can quickly work out, if you need to be a mathematical genius, you can win that election on having 34% of the votes. I mean, that is what Allende had, 34% of the votes. I mean, he was according to the Chilean constitution, he came into power. So you can't, I mean, quite apart from the fact you can't say that he was elected by socialists or the socialist votes behind him. He didn't even have a majority of people who wanted his reformist and state capitalist program. That's a bit of a red herring.
Well, it's only very brief. Shaw's Intelligent Woman's Guide, it certainly is a strange book. I've only read the first page, and Shaw talks about the Church of England being a communist institution, and that was
I've read the rest. It's even worse.
Peter.
I was just going to refer Adam and the meeting to other important sources of common ownership and that sort of thing, and that's the anthropological sources and the work of Morgan and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And in 1974 I actually spent 2 weeks living with a community in the Fijian island called Motariki, outlying island, and they had common ownership. It's tribal ownership of the land. They didn't need money, and they organise their affairs very, very well on a totally communistic type basis. And so these are other sources.
George.
The meeting and the speaker seem to be very much in favour of Morris. Nobody, I don't think I've heard anybody say outright Morris was a socialist.
Morris was a socialist.
I'm sorry?
Morris was a socialist.
Thank you. that's what I wanted. Now, Morris was a socialist. The Socialist Party is very strong on the theme that socialism is a working class movement. Would the Speaker please tell us whether Morris was a worker or a capitalist?
He was a capitalist. Full stop.
Anyone else? you've already spoken once, but I'll take it again if no one else wants to speak. Steve, yeah.
Some direct questions. Would anyone like to comment on Thomas Spencer's Utopia? I know we can sound that. And also, the other thing I was asking about is from the capitalist utopia, like for example, the New Atlantis. What was, perhaps you can say a few words comparing capitalist utopias with their vision and why they were based upon the material conditions that the capitalists found themselves in with the socialist utopia. I know you haven't got much time to tell that.
Right. If there are no others, then I think, well, if you've got...
I just asked a supplementary to the question on Chile, and that was when the Spanish Civil War was on, you know, like people in this country went and fought. George Orwell was one. He had read Morris about John Ball, and I'd read it. I had a great urge to go and fight. My best friends went and fought and died there, and... You know, I feel there is this question of fighting. I think possibly Morris would have gone. I think it had been wrong because really the struggle is in our own country. You know, we have got to get the change here. It's possibly, in a way, it's better to stay here and help them because we were able to do a lot of work in this country to help aid Spain. But there was a strong urge, and many, as I say, hundreds of young people went from this country and died actually. Would he apply the same thing to this Spain episode, Mr. Chilwell?
Right, Adam.
Okay, I mean, to come back to this question of other utopias, I did try to make the point, or to make a distinction between, you know, a utopia or a utopist or a utopian is somebody who writes about a future society, and that not all of these writers were merited, if you like, the title utopian socialist, because their utopias weren't going to be based on common ownership with the consequent, you know, implementation of production for use and the consequent disappearance of money and buying and selling. Well, I personally am not interested in these other types of utopias that haven't made. I'm not sure of a study of them, but there is one thing to come back to somebody like Thomas Spence, who was advocating that, there should be free access to the land, if you like. I mean, he didn't use the word himself, but, you know, land nationalisation. I mean, that made sense as already seen, you know, with Win Stanley, that when the land was, when most people were working on the land, this... The thing which people saw was wrong, that there was a class that stood in between them and that particular means of production, the land. And of course, when industrial capitalism develops, you've still got the same radical criticism of the landlord class, which is then transferred to the capitalist class. So you find the same sort of words being used. You know, the early capitalists are denounced by Chartists and others as money lords. And things like that. You know, this, and also this word monopoly, which Morris uses to, which I think is in fact, a very good word. It's much better than private property, which can suggest private legal titles and just individual ownership. The word monopoly is quite clear. It means that there is a group, it doesn't matter how they do it, who stands in between society and the means of wealth production. It was originally used by the advocates of, if you like, common ownership of the land, and in fact, it is one of the easiest ways to explain what we mean by socialism. In one of his talks, Morris gives the example of capitalism is like a field, and that field is, you know, the access to that field is monopolized by a group which has a capital policeman there to stop it, and it's saying you cannot have access to my field unless you pay me a tribute of 5 shillings. I mean, this is how, well, it's going to come back to, you know, monopoly or how labour is robbed. He says, look, what socialism is there would be free access for all people to that field to produce what they need to produce for their own livelihood. Of course, when you transfer this to the other means of production, the man-made means of production, the instruments of production, it becomes a bit more difficult to explain. But I mean, but the basic idea is still there, because obviously, whereas people can understand that one man can have access to a field to grow his own potatoes, they obviously the things like the railways or a modern factory can't be run on an individual basis. So what Morris talks about is free access to the means of production for workers duly organised for production, so that if you like, it's in the socialist system of society, there'll be obviously will be free access for individuals who want to produce things individually. But I mean, the main thing is going to be free access for people on a collective basis. And I think this is a very important point that we ought to make. Come back to this question of language, because sometimes we forget. You know, we talk about socialism being based on common property. That socialism will in fact mean the end of all property, because the very idea of property is that somebody is excluded. So in fact, technically speaking, common property could be a contradiction in terms. It's much better to explain that in a socialist system of society there'll be no property, there'll be no monopoly, but there'll be free access to the means of reproduction. Obviously you can't have free access on an individual basis. Therefore people will have to make social arrangements, have to organise themselves to use the means of production. In other words, in a socialist system of society, the concept of property, property ownership and property rights will be replaced by the idea of use, of having access to produce useful things. And I say, reading Morris today, I think this is as with reading, you would stand, if you use that type of language, you're not going to be misunderstood. But to come back to this point, by an unfortunate historical tragedy for us, we share the same language as people like in Russia, as people like in the Labour Party, who are advocating nothing in common with what we want, but who are advocating some form of state capitalism, where instead of being ruled and exploited by private capitalists and their hangers-on, we're ruled and exploited by government officials or political bureaucrats. I mean, we've got the same language as them, or they've got the same language as us, and it leads to an incredible amount of confusion, as with our friend over here, who seems to think that Allende and others have got something to do with socialism. Because, I mean, Allende, no doubt he could make a very stirring speech saying, we must have socialism, the land must be returned to the people. But he wasn't meaning the same thing. It was state capitalism and various social reforms, in particular land reform. I mean, to come back to the final question here about Morris and the civil war in Spain, it's very silly to speculate on what somebody would or would not have done, but I personally can't imagine somebody who had the views that Morris did on nationality, because I mean the quote was made this morning, that Morris, he described himself as a revolutionary international socialist, and then he signed his manifesto as national and international communism. We could and we do criticise that particular term, but it's quite clear that Morris said so, that he wanted the nation state to disappear. And this is where I think you are wrong when you say, look, we should stay in our own country and try to settle things here. I mean, that isn't possible, because we're living in a single integrated world, with a single integrated system of production, which is a capitalist system of production. Our enemy exists on a world basis, and this is another one of the things where William Morris was way ahead of some of the other things. I mean, at some stage, I haven't got access because I came by aeroplane. I couldn't bring a whole pile of books, but I would be capable of quoting about five or six quotes from William Morris where he says, look, the nation only exists as a competing group, first of all, to compete to sell things on the world market, and secondly, to defend that competition and those things in war. And obviously, once you have a system of society where there's no longer economic competition and there's no longer war, then you don't need the nation as a political form. I mean, this was one of the issues in which he was very clear on, and of course, which we are very clear on, which I'm afraid I can't agree with you on that one. That we can't agree with you on that one. That let's try and settle things here. But obviously, we speak in the English, the English language. It's our propaganda, our arguments, and so on will mainly be directed to people speaking English. But people speak English outside of this country.